Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinny Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on American Freedom Radio. Today I'm going to talk about a subject that is dear to my heart and dear to a lot of people, indeed probably about 20% of the population here in New Zealand. Cannabis, marijuana, pot, ganja, whatever your name for it is, it happens to be quite the hot topic, especially if you happen to be burning it up right now with a bong while you listen to the Vinny Eastwood Show, in which case very hot indeed, especially right on the cherry. Now, reason I'm bringing this debate up and topic today, and I don't have a guest for the first hour, by the way, those of you who think I might have had a veteran activist Penny Bright coming on, she'll be joining me in the second hour to talk about the Wellington Super City Council, Winston Peters, John Key threats and what have you to this new electorate that's being popped up for sale, more or less, in a by-election. That's spelt B-U-Y. That's right. But onto the topic of cannabis, recently one of the I'd probably stretch to say that he is the worst prohibitionist in New Zealand history, by that meaning he's the best and most effective person at keeping cannabis illegal. Now, there have been lots of allegations about this man, none of which I've seen evidence to prove are absolutely true. However, his work's history is suggestible. His name is Peter Dunn. And unlike his name would be suggest, he just never is. And so just thinking about this, you know how they have political assassinations and what have you to just, like, take somebody out and get them out of the way so you can put some scumbag in? I just thought about that. Well, isn't that, like, the most effective method of politicking ever? Just literally killing the person who's responsible for the policies that you don't like? Unfortunately, because I don't work for an intelligence agency, that's illegal! So I thought about this, a much better idea that is totally lawful, totally legal, and has the moral high ground. Targeted career assassinations. Just think about this. I know your mind is suddenly exploding with the prospect of a whole bunch of names that are just flooding to head of your local representatives and your dear leaders and what have you, of all these people who should go on this list for targeted career assassination. I'm talking about bringing out the dirt, the documents, the confessionals, the people that this person has screwed over, lied to, raped and destroyed, financed, whatever. All the dirt. All of the information that the mainstream media doesn't really want you to see. And the reason why they don't want you to see it is because they're part of the control structure too. And, well, you don't crap where you eat. Is the modus operandi, isn't it? How is that fair? Well, if you think you live in a fair society, you are completely and utterly deluded. That's my short and simple answer question for you. We do not live in a free society. Which is why ruthless criminal sociopathic scumbags have seized control of it. Because they're like, hey, dude, we've got a whole bunch of really gullible, honest people with integrity here who believe authority and believe that it has honour. So if we just tell them that we're the authorities and act honourable in public and do whatever the hell else we want all the rest of the time, they'll support us until such a point as they give us every single right and power that they have, and they'll be screwed, mate. And we'll be in the top tippy of everything. And we'll never have to obey a single law that we write again. Because we can just rewrite them. Or apply them selectively. Now, Peter Dunn recently went to a conference in Vienna. The United Nations talking about, well, you know how the United Nations set up the international treaty that basically banned cannabis worldwide, as long as a number of other drugs, of course. And recently, Portugal has shown that their approach to drug enforcement, of calling a doctor instead of the police, has been much more effective at curbing drug crimes as well. Because people are no longer afraid to ask for help. They're no longer afraid to have to explain why they have this health illness. They don't have to lie. And as a result, they wind up getting help for their actual illness as opposed to the current situation, whereas doesn't matter whether you tell the lie or the truth, you're not going to get medical help. You're not going to receive treatment. What you are going to receive is a jail sentence or a conviction, or you're going to have to give us a fine, depending on how rich and how white you are, basically. That's the general rule of thumb there. And if, under some circumstances, you manage to have a really, really bad run of things, like you get caught with a joint 3 times, well, we're going to pass some 3 strikes laws and we're just going to keep you in jail permanently. That sort of thing. Thank you, United Nations, for giving us the tools we need. So Peter Dunn's there, right? And they're reviewing medical cannabis. Now, I understand 2 elements of the medical cannabis equation. One, and Mr. Dunn is at least partly correct in his assertion here, that those who use recreational cannabis are trying to use medicinal cannabis and the legalization thereof as more or less gateway legislation towards full legalization, which I think is a perfectly legal and valid tactic. After all, that's exactly how the elite pass their legislation, don't they? They just pass one little thing here and everybody goes, ah, it's not that offensive. And then they pass a little thing to add onto it and they go, oh, that's not really that offensive by itself either. And then they pass another one and another one, and before you know it, you're encaged in shackles. So I believe that the opposite approach can indeed be valuable. You pass one little piece of legislation to roll back some of that scumbaggery, just a little bit of it, and then all the scumbags just go, ah, we'll just give them this one. And then you push the envelope again a few years down the track once they've all forgotten about it. Wouldn't it be fun if we use the very elements of conspiracy and scumbaggery against those who use it to prey on the weak and the vulnerable? I think that would be true justice. However, it'd be very difficult to maintain one's moral compass amongst such debauched company. And we all saw what happened to JFK when he tried. The point here that Mr. Dunn seems to be raising is that, oh, we don't want to have any of that medical cannabis available in New Zealand until we've had the exact same approach as all the rest of the scheduled drugs in our current supply, from Pharmac and goodness knows what other big pharma pill pushers. They've all been tested and they've got all these bands of safety and everything. No, they freaking haven't! Hardly any of them have even gone into stage 3, alright? Stage 3, which is, you know, quote-unquote human trials, is us, the general public. There's no way that they've proven all of these medications that are available out to be 100% safe for everybody. But Mr. Dunn claims that that cannabis might have all these unforeseen and terrible unknown side effects. So they, unlike all the rest of the drugs, in reality, not according to his words, of course, needs to be tested overly and excruciatingly and professionally and in such a grandiose manner as to be 100% sure that it couldn't possibly do any harm. And as justification, of course, we haven't done this research yet. Because why? Well, there's apparently not all that much demand in New Zealand for medicinal cannabis. And I suppose if you were like the government of a small country that literally doesn't have much population, there technically couldn't be big demand for anything except weed. Because in New Zealand, about 1 in 10 people smoke it daily. And I think maybe about 20% smoke overall. It's one of the highest rates in the world for people that admit to using cannabis recreationally. Number one being Jamaica, of course. Who incidentally also have the number one appreciation for reggae music. Guess who's number two? You guessed it, New Zealand. Reggae-tired man. Now this weird bathing, and this is the great irony of Peter Dunn. So blind, so incapable of seeing what is right in front of him and all around him is he, that even in one of the world's highest, and I mean that pun operatively, highest usage rates of cannabis in the world by a relatively wide margin still clings to this prohibitionist era dogma. And if he was so freaking concerned about safety, would he be putting in the legislation, by the way, if you arrest stoners and they're not hurting anybody or anything, don't beat them up, don't insult them, don't traumatize them for weeks or months with a long trial that gets laid out. Don't suck their bank accounts dry just so that they can plead guilty in the end because they can't continue to afford to pay for a lawyer. Instead of doing that, why don't you just give them a warning or something, you know? That keeps it illegal, and that keeps the damage from getting to them, either by the cannabis that they do, which we take and then go home and smoke later, thank you, New Zealand police, or or by not having all of those extra compounding costs, which damage the person, in some cases irrevocably, much more than the cannabis would. He does not, this politician creature does not see this. Okay. And as I alluded to earlier, there's some allegations floating around that have been floating around for some time. Mr. Dunn used to be on the Alcohol and Liquor Council of New Zealand. Now, why does liquor and alcohol need counselling? Here's why. Because you can lobby for things. And this is probably, I would say, the source of the allegations that he is being funded, in large part, by alcohol companies. There have also been allegations that he's being funded by tobacco companies. Dunn flatly denies this, of course, and says, no, even though he used to work on those advisory councils, which I think is a bit suspicious. And so I asked Mr. Dunn, so how much donations are you getting at? How's your funding being parted? How's your party being funded? And he gives me a link to elections.org.nz, where they hold a whole lot of official documents about election stuff. And I did manage to find it, you know, unbelievably. The PDF for the 2013 donations given to Peter Dunn's United Future Party. Drum roll, please. $0.00. Does that strike you as fantastically out of whack? For a mainstream political party that's in parliament to receive zero donations over a 12-month period of any kind. I was quite shocked and surprised. And I looked over at New Zealand First donations, and over there they only had like 2,400. And that was only donated by two people. And I was just like, oh my God, in the last 90 days, me, Vinny Eastwood, has raised like $8,000 for a new computer and a camera. I get more support by myself than entire political parties do in terms of donations. Where are these people getting all their money from? What, really? This is now just like a complete mess fest for me. Because I can't figure out how the government is getting its money to fund its political parties and things of this nature, or whether all the political parties are taking donations and they're not declaring them, and this whole range of suspicious possibilities starts popping up. And you know what's really terrible about my suspicious possibilities is that they're really, really cynical. You know what's worse than that? The fact that they're often correct, because I'm trying to assume the absolute worst, and usually the worst is what it is. These people are lying, manipulative, nasty people, in a very general kind of way, not pointing any fingers or naming any names. So I wouldn't put it past them to be concealing their sources of revenue. I mean, if I was a lying, cheating scumbag who takes money from private corporations and things like that, I'd make a pretty big effort to prevent that stuff from getting on elections.org.nz. Big tobacco company, $20,000 donation. You know, they'd probably work out some way around doing that. I mean, what does he do? Mail you a $5 bill a day or something of that nature just to make up the couple of grand that you need by the end of the year? I don't get the mechanism here. But I think financing and everything aside, the issue being cannabis, mate, this is a topic you can literally base a weekly radio show on, and nobody listening for a decade would ever hear the same thing twice. That's how big of a subject it really is to humanity. We'll be right back after the break at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Bear in mind, this is a listener-supported broadcast financed by your donations. So go to the homepage, the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, and make a donation or $5 a month today. We'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the show that's going a little bit bonkers. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. But there's nothing crazy about me. Yeah, I'm perfectly sane. Rational, aren't I? Don't I sound it? Voice going up and down the spectrum scale. I'm just totally messing with everybody today. But really, really, back to the subject at hand, which was cannabis. A friend of mine, Arik Reese, has released a documentary called Drug Lord. L-A-W-E-D, Drug Lord. And I recommend everybody go to www.druglord.com. I recommend everybody search Drug Lord on IMDb. Just search Drug Lord IMDb on Google. And if you can't, comment on IMDb. Then you can create one account easily if you've got Facebook, and just as easily if not. And rate it 10 stars. 10 stars. And I'm not asking you to do this without seeing the film. You can do that too, because I guarantee you you'll give it 10 stars anyway. This documentary is masterful. It's extraordinary. It is a landmark. This is something that has encapsulated what cannabis activists all around the world have been trying to tell people for years. How this whole prohibition got set up. How it was before Prohibition, with all the medicines and everything, and how it is now, and then truly how it affects society in such wide scope as to be more or less what some people would contend is the number one political issue of this generation. Legalizing cannabis. Really, go out to anybody in the street. Anybody in the street! And even the people who hate weed. And ask him, hey bro, do you think cannabis will be legal in the future? Everybody, even the people who hate weed, will say, well, yeah. Now my question is, and the question the film really poses, in a roundabout kind of way of course, is why not now? If it's going to happen anyway, why don't we just get it over and freaking done with? You know? I mean, it's not like puberty where you just have to let it run its course. We can do this today! We can release people from prison. We can spare a lot of sufferers of many diseases a shockingly large amount of pain. We can allow them the economic independence of growing their own medicine. We can start up industries around hemp. This thing would revitalize the world. In almost every facet of your life, cannabis can have an effect. Whether it be the 50,000 industrial uses of hemp, or the hundreds of different effects that the chemicals, whether that be the CBD or the THC, can have on the body. And the benefits thereof. Who? But a psychopathic criminal scumbag would not want that to happen. See, I'm drawing a blank. Ergo, the law was passed and is maintained by psychopathic criminal scumbags. Now, what's a psychopath? Psychopaths are somebody who's charming and enchanting when you first meet them, but hasn't really got any depth to their personality or long-lasting relationships, and ultimately is willing to lie, cheat, sabotage, steal, defame, and bully other people into doing what they want. That's a psychopath. Plus, with the added benefit that they don't feel guilty about it either. They feel no remorse. No pity. like the Terminator. Just now that I think about it. And that's why they destroy people's lives so easily. All right. And if you think, oh, no, a psychopath can't just destroy a person's life that easily. Legislation can't do that. Really? Obviously, you've not spent time in a jail cell when the police raided your home that where you were growing cannabis because a drunk driver took off your leg and nothing else works to get rid of the pain. Nothing else takes the rashes away. And you have to go to court for months in your wheelchair to stand trial because you're so evil that you grew a plant in your greenhouse to heal yourself so that life would be bearable and possible so that you can still move round and still retain some sort of normality from your previous life which a drunk driver took from you. Obviously that hasn't happened to you, as it has happened to Billy McKee, who started Green Cross New Zealand. I get real uppity about this because I have seen the pain and destruction that the law causes. I haven't seen a whole lot of harm come from the cannabis. I've seen a whole lot of people not do stuff that would be good for them, but nobody'd like to go out of their way and actually do stuff that was bad for them in order to get weed. Like, really? Have you ever seen anybody, I don't know, giving fellatio on the street for some cannabis? No? Yeah. It's only crack and coke for that, isn't it? There's no real problem here. I mean, if the problem was so bad, the fact that 87% of New Zealanders aged above 15 and upwards to 25, and this study was a few years old, by the way, 87% of them had tried cannabis. 52% up to the age of 54. Again, the study's a few years old. The majority of people either have smoked it or are smoking it. If there was any truth that society would collapse and things would just go awry and people would get really badly into desperation and start spending their money on a tinny instead of feeding their kids or anything, if there was a real problem like that, we would have seen it. And there are real problems like that. And you know what the cause is? Alcohol! There are drunk people everywhere in this country. It is unfreaking believable. Oh my god. I mean, I like to drink. Like, I really do. But I don't like to drink with people who don't know how to drink. Really. If you're getting aggro, if you're repeating yourself over and over, if you're vomiting, if you're being annoying, then you don't know how to drink. And you probably shouldn't be drinking, bro. If it's making you slow, stupid, not have a good time, and make other people uncomfortable and or injured as a result of you drinking too much, time to give up the drink, son. All right? And if you're getting like that, after a lot of them, you probably shouldn't be drinking at all. Or at least that's in my experience. I have a couple of mates who were like this. As soon as they stop drinking, no problem. Ever. Again. Like, literally, it was that simple. Ah, no, I'm not drinking anymore, bro. I just turn into a bad, bad person. And their life benefits just kind of, like, flow on from there. Now, not to make this into an alcohol bashing thing. As I said, I do like to have a drink. But when you want to point blame at something, blame the thing that's actually responsible. That's all I'm saying. It's not New Zealanders' fault that we smoke cannabis like nobody's frickin' business. It's not our fault. We've got a hole in the ozone layer. It allows more UV radiation to come through, which forces the plants that are growing outdoors to grow more tetrahydrocannabinol crystals on the leaves in order to reflect and refract that sunlight so that they don't get burnt by it in the hot, hot New Zealand sun. You ever go out in the New Zealand sun for more than 5 minutes? Bro, you'd be red as a lobster. This sun is killer. But cannabis has evolved over a long, long time to deal with that kind of stuff by making itself even stronger to smoke. I didn't make the laws of physics up, bro. I don't even know if physics is involved in the equation. All I know is this country has the strongest dope. All right? Everybody who's ever traveled around the world knows it. And so the mind reels when you think that it's illegal here, when you think that we have the highest arrest rate on record. Every 30 seconds, some young male under 25 years old is being busted for a cannabis crime. I say that very specifically, and of course it's not the entire statistic in and of itself, but I did go and ask a police officer once when I was writing a paper for university, what do you look for when you look for cannabis smokers? Without batting an eye, he says, groups of males under 25. All right, so parents out there, if you think your kids aren't smoking pot, you're probably wrong. They might be. Always warn them, because if you know that pot's not that bad for you, but you really just kind of don't want them to smoke it, at least give them some advice and say, dude, if you are smoking it, don't smoke it around kids your own age. All right, in big groups of you, out in the open where people can see you, or in cars. That's stupid. You need to be far, far out of the way. You know, we want to have like somebody actually, you'd need to have one of your group be an agent of the FBI in order for them to bust you far away. That's what I'm saying. You don't want kids to go through what it's like being arrested. Many parents have tried, and they go, oh, it'll teach them a lesson. Yeah, it teaches them a lesson that they don't like authority. And because you're one of their parents and an authority figure, they start not liking you. Even worse than it was before. Because it's on top of authority not allowing them to do what they want with their life, it's authority punishing them for not doing what they want with their life. Okay? Kids are real simple. If they don't like what they're getting, and if they don't have to earn what they got, they won't have any respect. That's pretty much it. If you don't have to work for anything and it's just handled for you on a silver platter, then the second that you get asked to do something you don't want to do, you resist. But if you have to earn everything that you got, and you have to show respect in order to get rewarded, then you wind up being respectful when somebody asks you to do something. Or at least that's what I've found. And when it comes to being busted by the cops, they have, like, no rules, man. Oh, my God. It very much varies. And heard statistics anything like 13 to 14%. And that's an inflated figure for the police. 13 to 14% of police liable for corrupt practices, corrupt behavior, charges, liable to go to court, that kind of thing, officially. So that means you've got almost better than a 1 in 10 chance for a street cop to be corrupt when he busts you. Now, you can't bribe New Zealand cops, not like you can in Phuket or one of those other holiday destinations in some underdeveloped nation. This is a real mafia type thing going on here, much like it is in New York and Chicago, I would say, because we've also got gun bans. And you know what happens in gun ban zones, ladies and gentlemen? Mafia come in, because criminals don't have to turn their guns in. Why? Because they don't know you've got them. But all the registered people who use their firearms for self-defense, they do. And then you watch that handgun shooting rate go skyrocketing up as soon as all the innocent people hand in all their guns that they used to use to protect themselves. Every single time. It's unbelievable. Not saying that there's a huge murder rate in New Zealand, but there's something really, really messed up about that. And especially when you're making a cash crop illegal, it gives a lot of incentive to criminals, doesn't it? Aren't criminals in crime to make money? I mean, did I miss a policy paper on this one? Am I mistaken? Like, oh, they must be just doing it for the good of the community. No, they're in it to make money. And if they're selling cannabis and it's making money, well, why the hell shouldn't we be selling it? Why the hell shouldn't we be making the money? The people. Doesn't that make a lot more sense than giving it wholesale market control to black market criminals? Oh, wait. What's this over here? Oh, it looks like the police and the gangs are tied up, and there's a number of people in very well-placed positions who brokered deals for certain things and certain services. You scratch my back, I'll scratch somebody else's eyes out for you. How's that? That'll be nice, beautiful, fantastic. And I think society wouldn't collapse. In fact, it would run smoothly. It would run so swimmingly that you would want the gangs to be hired to mow your council lawns. And guess what they just did in Dunedin? You guessed it. They negotiated with the heads of Black Power Gang to mow the council's lawns. You're going to have council trucks, bladed weapons, and everything in the parks and reserves. Now, nothing makes me feel safer than gang members in the parks and reserves in the middle of the night. So, you know, that'll be nice. We'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the final segment of the first hour here. Just ranting alone, you know, as you do. Time zone changes, eh? What you gonna do? Hey, Penny, it's gonna be on at 4 p.m. All right, I'll be there. All right, Vinnie, you numbnuts. It's actually 3 p.m. that it starts in New Zealand now. 4 days a week, ladies and gentlemen, from Monday through Thursday in New Zealand now, thanks to that daylight savings lovingly in the United States. It pushes us back by 1 hour, and then we go through daylight savings and then push it back by another. So eventually we'll be broadcasting from 2 till 4 p.m, but at the moment it's 3 till 5. God, I'm going to get this destroying my head someday. Whew. But for winter months, it'll basically roll on through for a good 6 months in the same time slot here in New Zealand. So that's going to be good for everybody to listen into during work hours. You know, a lot of messages from listeners listening on in the American Freedom Radio stream on their smartphones and just with their headphones in or whatever. The boss doesn't know. So I love to encourage subversive behavior, but I'm not allowed to. So, you know, you can take what you will from that. Now, wrapping up this, I wanted to say as well, when it comes to the cannabis issue, New Zealand, of course, being number one arrest rate, almost number one users per capita, and having a relatively massive black market industry, huge potential cottage industry could prop up and everything. It just makes sense, really. I mean, how many people go just from France to Amsterdam alone every year, according to the EU? 1 million people going to Amsterdam from France alone every year, specifically to go and smoke cannabis legally. Now, guess what New Zealand's number one industry is? You guessed it, tourism. You wouldn't think that a South Pacific Island nation would have a lot of tourism. Of course we freaking do. The adventure capital of the world, for goodness sake. But guess who our freaking tourism minister is? You guessed it, the Prime Minister, John Key, who's an ex-Federal Reserve banker. I'm not 100% sure where the Federal Reserve bankers are very, very tight on the cannabis issue. But just think, okay? Some people don't vote with their hearts, so you tell them about medical people suffering, they don't care. You tell them about young people getting abused by cops, having their lives ruined, etc., being traumatized for the rest of their life and never being able to truly get over it and affecting their entire work career and work life and job prospects as well with a criminal conviction, all of that stuff, they don't care. You tell them they can make some money out of it, suddenly their ears prick up. Oh, really? Yes. You can have a whole lot of non-violent drug users who want to come to the adventure capital of the world, do some adventure sports, and then afterwards maybe smoke a joint in a cannabis cafe in Queenstown or something, or they look over the beautiful, pristine lake. I'm not 100% sure how pristine it is, but it's a lake, and it's pretty freaking nice. Really. You're going to go to my YouTube channel, or you want to search either You Have to Save Yourself or Avengers Rant on Vinnie Eastwood on YouTube, and you'll see some of the footage that I took of Queenstown and that particular central Otago area. This is a good place for tourism, and I think if a weed was legal here, even better. Not only for the local residents who don't want to be, I don't know, There's a whole other surveillance element to this as well, isn't there? Tapping phones, sucking out people's text messages, emails, etc., as an excuse to catch people. Well, that's a real problem, because you're going to start to get into a totalitarian state. First of all, you made it illegal in the first place. It wasn't harming anybody in order to necessitate it being made illegal in the first place. But you just made up some lies, didn't you? Was it Harry or Henry? J. Anslinger. I really think the J was an interesting middle name for somebody who was responsible for such a large part of the prohibition of cannabis era, and still has his roots and his fingers in that pie today. Well, is he even dead yet? I freaking hope so. I know that's a terrible thing to say, but my goodness, there are some people who just don't seem to die, and they always seem to be the nastiest, most horrific, evil people who are corrupt to the gills that just keep freaking surviving. Why do they keep being alive? You know, it's almost like destroying life is the point of their life, and they ain't done destroying it yet. They're like, oh, I can't leave until the job's over. It's kind of how it works, isn't it? That's why, you know, that's only good people that get assassinated. Right? Because the bad guys have assassins working for them. The good guys don't. Good guys wouldn't even think about it. They just don't assassinate people. And that's why you get the John Lennons and all bunches of other creative and historically significant protesting and activist figures who get murdered. Malcolm X springs to mind. Gunned down. Isn't it sad? I think something that Bill Hicks said, isn't it sad that we kill all the people that want to advance us down the path to human glory, and we let the demons run amok? Because when we're talking about any country now, you can see that the demons have run amok. Have they not? They've certainly messed the place up. It's quite funny, I'm putting up information about New Zealand politicians recently on Facebook, and I get a whole bunch of people replying from the United Kingdom. And basically, you swap out the name of the New Zealand politician, but still all the corruption and scumbaggery that they're alleged to be responsible for, and you transplant that name with one particular UK politician, and they're virtually identical. That's why I came to the realization that we now have a global order, and we have the same problems. They just have different accents, different names, that kind of thing. And I'm wondering how badly sovereignty is under threat when we have things like international treaties that ban benign plants and things like that. We don't really have any. And to a large degree, this new Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which I'm not 100% sure if old Peter Dunn has done there for that, but and also the TTIP, nobody's talking about that in the media. It's because they're all part of the same agenda. They're all pulling the same Trojan horse. They've all been slaving away for goodness knows how long, trying to keep the truth from people. Trying to learn how to be better liars so they can do their job more effectively. I mean, that's what a good employee does, doesn't they? They take the job description, put their own spin on it, and do it better than the job description states that they should be. That's the kind of employee you want. And lo and behold, we got him. Working in the media. Now, wasn't it a shame? I think it was, what was it, last year or the year before, I forget which. There was a episode of The Vote. Now, The Vote's kind of like a 7 p.m. prime time New Zealand program run by lead figures in the New Zealand media. And they pick an issue, a yes or a no issue, like cannabis or no cannabis, and they debate it. And then everybody in the audience votes, people of New Zealand vote, and then you kind of get the result. And then they call up a politician who might, you know, want to be interested in that result and see what they have to say about it. And in this particular case, after an hour-long debate of these pro-cannabis people wiping the freaking floor with these lying, pretentious prohibitionist scum. Wiping the floor with them. It was like that scene from Spaceballs where Dark Helmet comes after Lone Star and Lone Star just holds his helmet and he just waves his little lightsaber wildly, can't land a blow. It's just pathetic. It was hilarious. And then you get the vote result and it's like 70%+ in favour of full legalisation. And then they call up Peter Dunne. And they go, so what do you think of this result? And he goes, oh, cannabis is not on our agenda. Record stops. You know, the needle gets dragged off instantly. He doesn't freaking care what anybody thinks. He doesn't freaking care what any of the facts are about cannabis. And this guy is our associate health minister. The guy who spearheads anti-cannabis legislation. And people freaking listen to him! He can come out and say, Hey, cannabis is really bad. It makes white women have sex with black men. Everybody else would go like, oh, really? And I'd be like, he's killing me. He's freaking killing me. Oh, you need to stifle that cackle. It's unbelievable how ridiculously, hilariously out of proportion the facts are with his point of view. I'm sorry, Mr. Dunne, if you ever get a chance to listen to this, just please start listening to things, all right? Really, clearly you haven't listened to anything since 1973, but it's never too late, bro. And it's never too late to politically assassinate your own career. All right? Because, for goodness sake, you should just come out in favour of cannabis, then all the support that you used to have would be withdrawn, and then all new pro-cannabis people would come in and replace your ass. That would be really, really nice right about now! But anyway, ladies and gentlemen, please donate to the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. $5 a month is what we ask, just so that we can keep continuing to provide you with the benefits of hearing activists and other researchers and journalists, etc., from around the world speak to their full and brightest potential. Give them a nice platform. They freaking deserve it. We'll be right back after the break at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand, the perceived least corrupt country in the world. And there's a reason why I use the word perceived, because perception and reality aren't always the same thing. And my very special guest joining me, her worship herself. And a lot of people think the title Her Worship doesn't go down with very well with a lot of people, and I disagree. Warships often go down with a lot of people. It's Penny Bright. Welcome to the program.
Oh, hi, Vinny. How are you?
Somewhat fabulous now that you're here. Sorry about the mix-up there about the timings of today, but...
Oh.
But anyway, all good. I know that you're always busy, and always and busy are both understatements in and of themselves, so there's a couple of topics we wanted to narrow it down to. So first of all, I wanted to talk about the quote-unquote by-election in Northland, about the National versus New Zealand First debacle. Secondly, we'd like to think about the Mangawhai ratepayers meeting, where Winston is going to be attending. And then lastly, I'd like to close off by talking about the Wellington Super City and the kind of, I don't know, stoushes that are going on there between the mayors who want the city and the mayors who don't.
Right. Okay. First things first, I believe that this Northland by-election, that BUY election, otherwise known as the Northland Bribe, I believe, for a number of reasons.
Sorry, you'll have to restate that, Penny. You'll have to restate that. We had a cutout on your audio there for a second.
Okay. I believe that this Northland by-election, that's BUY by-election, or otherwise known as the Northland bribe election, is going to go down in history as quite a yardstick event. And the reason for that is that when Winston Peters storms home on March the 28th, 2005, and helps to take Northland off National, then I believe that John Key, Brand Key, will really go down the gurgler. And the reason for that is that his carefully spin-doctored image of Mr. ex-Wall Street banker, that Mr. Okey Blokey, ordinary guy, New Zealander, was actually punctured majorly when, in front of, I think over a million people have seen this video clip where our trader, Prime Minister, was trying to be a tradee and he couldn't even bang a nail into a bit of wood. And seriously, I mean, this is the country of New Zealand, proud do-it-yourselfers. Here's the leader of this country of do-it-yourselfers. He can't even bang a single nail into a piece of wood.
That's because so he's pay someone else.
Get Bronny to get a man in. That raises all sorts of issues, but we won't go there. But, so it's years of carefully crafted spin doctoring where how do you transmogrify this ex-Wall Street banker into Mr. Ordinary Bloke that ordinary people will just want to queue up to shake the hand of? And what you do is you just mix and mingle with as many people as possible and just pretend to be ordinary when, of course, you're from the 1% and you're looking after the interests of the 1%, and it's all as phony as hell. And I think that one tiny little clip, which has had over a million views, has really helped puncture that hot air balloon in a way that he'll never get back that perceived credibility that Mr. Popularity once had.
So let me get this straight. He couldn't puncture a piece of wood with a nail, and that punctured his credibility.
Absolutely. Just seeing him try to hammer in a nail when he keeps missing it, and then, of course, what happened was that Winston Peters seized the moment and got a 9-second video clip of him, how a real Kiwi bloke hammers in a nail, and that had over 100,000 hits. And, I mean, you compare the two things, but there's been moments in history where there's been certain photos that have absolutely destroyed the political careers of politicians. There was the famous Michael Dukakis photo of him, who he was a Democratic presidential candidate back in the 1980s, and he was seen by George Bush Sr. as being soft on war. So there's this picture of Michael Dukakis in a tank, but it was regarded as one of the big, 10 biggest PR failures of all time. Mm-hmm. So, so I think that this nail fail will go down in history as John Key's Michael Dukakis moment.
Well, let's hope his political campaign Dukakis it.
Indeed. Yes, well, I think that's well underway. I mean, see, John Key made so light of, Winston didn't have a dog show, and next minute, oh my God, he's leading in the polls, and talk about the panic button. So it would appear that at the end of the day, New Zealand part-time Prime Minister John Key is not anywhere near as comfortable and relaxed as he might have been, because he's cutting short his state visit to Japan in order to campaign for National in the Northland by-election. And that raises all sorts of issues as well, because there's a whole flood of National Party ministers and MPs flooding up to Northland, taking their flash limousines on the potholed gravel roads up there. And the question is that how much money is actually being spent and accounted for? Because Mark Osborne, the National Party candidate, is only allowed to spend $52,100 on a by-election, including GST. So how is all this National Party support being calculated in an accountable and proper way?
Well, I mentioned in the first hour about how I went to elections.org and I had a look at the donations PDFs from the parties that they put up themselves, yes, and sign off and stamp off. United Future got zero for the year of 2013. public, private, everything, every kind of donation, zero. Winston Peters, yes. New Zealand First, got like 2,400. And I was like aghast. It's like, whoa, that seems awfully low for an elected party.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, we're now looking at expenses for this by-election, but my understanding is the reason why Winston Peters has chosen to stand in Northland is because a lot of apparently former National Party members have asked him to do so. And my understanding is there is a lot of serious discontent and disquiet over why they're having a by-election, which is costing $1 million, why they're having a by-election in the first place, arising from Mike Sabin, the former National Party MP, resigning under very mysterious and murky circumstances.
The official story is, quote, personal reasons. Now, I don't know about you, but whenever somebody says personal reasons, it's reasons they don't want nobody to find out about.
Well, the thing is that, in my view, if you're a public elected representative and suddenly you're out of the house, then people are entitled to know why. And apparently he's faced police investigations for what exactly is not quite clear, but rumours are abounding. But the point is, if he was dodgy, why was he reselected as a candidate? Why was he reselected as a candidate? And I think that's the thing that a lot of National Party people are not happy about in Northland, that if there were all these allegations floating around, he wasn't basically fit for duty and he should never have been reselected as a candidate.
Allegations? Allegations about what? Do you know any rumours? Is there any public speculation?
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks they might know?
Yeah, there is. There is. There's some serious public suppression orders there. But, hopefully it will come to light soon. But you can't say because of suppression orders. It's not a good look at all. But the thing is that what cracks me up is that after part-time Prime Minister John Key saying that Winston didn't have a show, next minute, the message is certainly being given to the National Party. Well, the fact there's a huge public spotlight on Northland now, and now there's bridges and infrastructure and all manner of things being promised.
Can we put two things down here? I mean, it has been a National Party electorate for, 55 years? And the election bribe, almost the carte blanche bribe, was 10 bridges being upgraded from a one-lane to a two-lane. And then after Winston gets high in the polls, Mr. Key says, oh, well, we won't upgrade the bridges then if Winston wins. It's kind of like you're holding the region to ransom if you want a bribe. Oh, you don't like my bribe? Well, how about some threats then, eh? Eh? How'd you like that?
Okay, well, the thing is this, that bribery under New Zealand electoral law is an offence, okay? And this is what I believe is a bribe, in my view. Okay, this is a direct quote from Mark Osborne, as reported in an article, just bear with me, on the 13th of March this year, where it is stated, Mark Osborne, who has risen from electorate treasurer, so he was Mike Sabin's electorate treasurer, which raises the questions, well, how much did he really know about Mike Sabin and why he had to resign? But anyway, Osborne, who has risen from electorate treasurer to potential MP in just weeks, even warned a flagship national roading project to extend State Highway 1 as a motorway further into Northland could be derailed if Peters beat him. Quote, if the people of Northland want the Puhoi to Wellsford motorway extension, which is vital to open up Northland to our biggest market, if we want that, there's only one choice, and that's to vote for me, Osborne said. Well, with all due respect, when you look at the underpinning Electoral Act, okay, Section 216 is what deals with, let me see if I can find it, Section 216 deals with bribery. And I'm just trying to get it up on my screen.
While you're looking for that, I also wanted to note as well that when this election's happening, it kind of makes a bit of a pivotal move, and it's got the country sort of focused on it. And not to mention the fact that these new roading highway projects and everything, Northland mayors have been requesting for years, and are just now getting to the consent process and everything with them anyway. So they're using this pivotal moment to try and jockey people for things that were probably going to happen pretty soon anyhow.
Well, there's all that, but I've found it now. Okay, so New Zealand Electoral Act 1993, Section 216, bribery, subsection 1. Every person is guilty of a corrupt practice who commits the offence of bribery. Subsection 3. For the purposes of this section, A, advances or pays or causes to be paid any money to or to the use of any other person with the intent that that money or... I read the wrong bit. Sorry. 3. For the purpose of this section, A, references to giving money shall include references to giving, lending, agreeing to give or lend, offering, promising, or promising to procure or endeavour to procure any money or valuable consideration. Everybody's talking about bribes in Northland, but it's no point howling at the moon, Vinny. As you know, nothing happens until you put something into a sausage machine with an outcome. I'm waiting this afternoon for a reply from the Electoral Commission to find out to whom exactly I make a formal complaint against National candidate for Northland, Mark Osborne, for alleged bribery under Section 216 of the Electoral Act.
And that's on the basis...
Put it in the sausage machine. Yep.
And that's on the basis of his election promises about the bridges and the highways, etc.
Where I think a line is crossed is basically, if this is a candidate who, if elected, would be part of the government, they hold the Treasury purse strings. And so the concept that if you don't vote for me, then you won't get this, then I believe that is absolutely crossing a line. That is crossing a line, in my view. Anyway, I believe it needs to be tested, and the way to test it is to actually make a formal complaint. And you will remember that I was one of the three people that made a complaint against John Banks to the police over alleged, basically, electoral fraud. And that started off a process, and the end of it was that John Banks ended up having to resign from Parliament. So, but had I and two others not initiated that process, then there would have been an outcome. You can't just whine about stuff. You need to actually get it into a process with an outcome. And I'm getting directly from the horse's mouth, which is the Electoral Commission, the proper process to follow. To whom do I make the complaint? Is it the police? Is it the Electoral Commission? Because the Act is not clear. So I get that from the horse's mouth by 5 o'clock today, and tomorrow I hope to initiate a formal complaints process.
Well, I see it more along the lines of a game of gridiron, actually, Penny. You're the quarterback. You're the one who actually has to make the play. Everybody else is here to basically keep others off your back so that you can take your shot. Penny, I'm sorry, we're going to have to go to break right about now. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the show with the extraordinarily loud outro music. And we'll be right back after the break with veteran activist, Her Worship, Penny Bloody Bright. We'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide. Just because we're being exterminated doesn't mean we can't make it fun. Otherwise, what's the point of being killed? And my very special guest is a PM Bright, and I'm proud to call you that. Welcome back.
Thank you. So, what else do we...
We wanted to encapsulate the last of it. You were reading off the legislation in terms of the bribery. I get that because this is something that hasn't, I've never actually seen before. Like, I can't remember a single example where somebody would actually come out, offer something, and then say that if you elect somebody else, I'm going to withdraw my offer. Like, they've never explicitly stated that. That's always been kind of, like, assumed. So the fact that they felt the need to state that, they felt the need to threaten the electorate with some kind of a penalty if they dare vote for somebody else, that's kind of unique. This is dark territory we're getting into.
Well, it's interesting because I've tried Googling and I can't actually come across any previous test cases where anyone in New Zealand has actually made a complaint for alleged bribery in an election and of this form. So, it could be quite an interesting little test case. So I'm really looking forward to getting the clear steer from the Electoral Commission on how to progress this.
As I always say, if nobody's done it before, that's enough reason for me to do it.
Indeed. Yeah, so exciting times. But the key thing here, of course, is that Northland's much bigger than Northland in terms of the political ramifications. And the reason for that is that if or when Winston Peters storms home and takes Northland off National, then the National government will be left with 59 out of 121 MPs, which will make it a lot more difficult for them to get legislation through the House. Because instead of just railroading it through, by having one MP less means it's going to be more difficult for lots of pieces of legislation which don't have the support of the United Future Party or the Māori Party.
Which would be specifically one thing, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, wouldn't it?
Well, actually, it appears that that it's not Parliament that has to agree to the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. It can just be done through Cabinet, which is outrageous. But in terms of legislation, it seems to be the Resource Management Act or changes to it that National will lose the ability to be able to railroad through if they're one MP down. Well, it's just like when we got John Banks ended up having to resign from Parliament last year, that the government was hamstrung and they couldn't force through changes to employment legislation to help take away workers' smokers, etc., because they simply didn't have the numbers in the House. They only had 60 MPs they could rely on and they needed 61. So, I mean, people just need to get it. It's much bigger than Northland, which is why I'm really, really doing everything I can to try to encourage people strategically vote Winston Peters for Northland. And it seems like in New Zealand, the so-called right get strategic voting, like they have done for some time in Epsom, but they haven't really got it as far as the so-called left is concerned. I mean, I got 420 votes in Helensville when I stood against John Key, and all I wanted was the electorate vote, and all the political parties wanted the party vote. So why they didn't just give me their electorate vote, it just proves that they didn't get strategic voting. However, that's another yardstick, I believe, that will be shown by this Northland campaign. It will be the first time the so-called left have got strategic voting. Why would you waste your vote as a Labour Party supporter on Willow Jean Prime, their candidate, although I think the woman's very promising, why would you waste your vote when you could help absolutely clip the wings of the national government? Give your Labour vote to Winston Peters. Give your Mana Party vote to Winston Peters. Everybody who's got a vote and a brain, vote Winston Peters for Northland. That's my recommendation.
Because Northland currently holds the key to the country to a large degree. At least in that particular way, it's not going to be enough to stop the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which is, oh my God, I can't even, you know, I try to imagine how bad things could possibly be in certain things, Penny, and a lot of the time I'm either right, I'm capable of imagining how bad they are because I assume the worst, in other cases I'm wrong because they're much worse than I could ever possibly imagine.
Well, the thing is that where the people lead, the politicians will follow. And the thing is to keep the pressure on against the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That's all about corporate control. But what gets me is that in Auckland, the biggest city and now the second least perceived corrupt country in the world, we've been under direct corporate control for 4 years. I mean, you understand it. I've fought against it literally from day one. There's been a tiny handful of us who have fought this corporate takeover, but now I think more people are waking up to it. But we have been under direct corporate control through a corrupt corporate coup, which was when central government railroaded through the Auckland Super City, forced amalgamation of the Auckland region. That's a reality. But
And now they're doing it to Wellington.
Well, I think that we've managed to really help hit it on the head. I spent days and days and days down in Wellington, like the big Auckland bazooka, who have, you know, I've got facts and evidence and experience that nobody else has, and that's a fact, exposing just what a crock Auckland, the Auckland super city for the 1%, has been for the majority of us. And what was fascinating was I flushed out of Auckland Council this dynamite Official Information Act reply on the 27th of February, 3 days before submissions were closing on the draft Wellington Super City proposal, which provided the evidence that there is no evidence of the purported efficiencies of this forced amalgamation in Auckland. That's a really big deal. There are no Auckland efficiency. That's just a load of bollocks. And the other thing is that given that the whole purpose of amalgamations is supposed to be for future cost effectiveness, there's been no information provided in Wellington, just like there never was in Auckland. Where do the costs fall now? How much now are council services and regulatory functions actually costing on a line-by-line basis? And nobody has provided that evidence. So unless you know where the costs fall now, what basis, factual basis, do you have to measure any cost effectiveness?
Well,
it's just bollocks.
Well, this is ironically almost word for word what you were saying in the original Super City, because there was no evidence then, and there's no evidence now. And I, and strangely enough, it just keeps getting pushed through. So that leads me to one inescapable conclusion, that somebody has to gain from a Wellington Super City. Who is that that has a lot to gain? And who is it that has a lot to lose? I'd wager it's the corporate contractors that have an awful lot to gain, and I'd wager it's all the people who participate in something called democracy have a lot to lose.
Well, it's exactly right. And having been through opposing the Auckland Super City from day one, the play has been basically identical. It's really interesting. What's happened is that you've had mayoral forums which of course are not a creature of statute under New Zealand law, which have come up with recommendations to help push for this Wellington super city. You've got groups like the New Zealand Council for Infrastructural Development, who represent major companies to set up with their snouts in the public trough. Bigger contracts for fewer but bigger private contractors, the same people. And what they argue, it's a race to the bottom. What they're arguing is that you need this amalgamation, you need this one voice, which is a crock. Auckland used to have 8 councils, got rid of 7 of them, and we ended up with 1 council, but then we got 7 council-controlled organisations. So we swapped 7 democratically elected councils, warts and all, for 7 undemocratic council-controlled organisations run by unelected boards of business people, unelected CEOs. We don't know where exactly the money's going. We're talking billions here. We don't know exactly where the money's going. Again, it's bigger contracts for fewer bigger private contractors. Rates have gone up. Debt has gone up. Transparency, democracy and accountability have just fallen away.
You know, anybody who just like turned up all of a sudden, they'd say, hey, these guys are setting up a fascist dictatorship.
Well, isn't... yeah. Well, look at what they've done. Look at what they tried to do to me. I mean, here's little old me having a go and refusing to budge, making a stand for transparency, and they try to sell my house on me on the basis of a fundamentally flawed judgment that was based on fundamentally flawed evidence, and there'll be a lot more to come on that one because that's a lot of unfinished business, but that's the reality. I'm their biggest pain in the neck because I won't shut up, and that's what they're trying to do, neck stamp me and try and make an example of me in case other people get the Penny Bright disease and actually dispute and refuse to pay their rates, because that's the direct action that you take.
It's kind of like Lou Gehrig's disease. Only one person really gets it, eh?
Well, the thing is that, like I keep saying, in my view, it doesn't take a cast of thousands to make a difference. It's the depth of the stand, not the breadth of the stand. The more, the merrier. But here's me, one person rates revolt, and now we've got this huge public spotlight starting to really look a lot harder at transparency and accountability and democracy under Auckland Council. One guy climbs a kauri tree in West Auckland, and that stops it being cut down. You've got to take the direct action that stuffs up what it is they're trying to do.
And you have to have people see you doing it as well. Because no doubt, if that guy in the tree and you over your house being sold by Auckland City Council had received no media coverage of any kind, the likelihood of you pulling off what you needed to and getting the public support you required in order to pull it off wouldn't have existed. And so,
no, that's exactly you need the public. It's court of public opinion. In order to win in the court of law, court of public opinion is really, really important. But I think because Auckland Council's so unpopular anyway, that was quite a stand to take. I mean, I had all sorts of people saying, oh, Penny, you know, you've done enough, you've made a stand, but, you know, your house is at risk here. And I just thought, stuff this. I mean, I've made a stand for over 7 years on this. I'm not wrong and I'm not backing down. And when it comes to crunch time, that is exactly the time that you have to be absolutely resolute. So here we are, staring at each other, me versus Auckland Council, and basically the council blinked first.
Yeah, and the council was like seven times bigger than it used to be.
Well, that's exactly right. And it's like that. What really gets me is like they have a bottomless pit of public money to use against the public and the public interest, and that stinks to high heaven as far as I'm concerned. It's really not okay. Yeah,
and Wellingtonians will enjoy it next.
Seriously, I do believe that we actually have actually hit it on the head, because they actually do get it down there. Heaps of them do.
Can
get
I ask,
it.
Penny? Has the media been covering it, though? Like, remember that pivotal point that we just made? Is the media covering the anti-Wellington super city side of things?
There has been coverage. But, of course, the thing is that, I mean, Auckland's not up on planet Mars. I mean, there's all sorts of people that are linked from Wellington to Auckland. They have family, friends. And, of course, you know, the number of people that think Auckland Council is the best thing since sliced bread, you can probably get them in a telephone box.
I think you could actually fill a council debating chamber with them.
I think that's made an impression as well, because the more Wellington folk hear about the disaster that the Auckland Super City Council has been, the less they want anything to do with it. And what got me was just how blatant the lies were down in Wellington about the Auckland Super City and their background. I mean, back on the 5th of September 2006, where my good friend, fellow community activist Lisa Prager and myself gate-crashed the Auckland Town Hall with an hour's notice because we were told there was a big thing happening there, that four of the mayors, the mayors of Auckland City Council, Manukau City Council, Waitaki City Council, North Shore City Council, basically all ganged up on Mike Lee and the Auckland Regional Council on behalf of big business. They wrote this open letter to then Labor Prime Minister Helen Clark and said, we need to move fast. What we need to do is we need to set up basically the super city. And Lisa and I gate crashed. It was Lisa first off the mark, said, you've got no lawful authority to do this. And we completely disrupted it and closed it down, basically. And that was the first step in the process that they relied upon to get that super city council. And Bob Harvey was one of the ringleaders for the failed mayoral coup, as it became known, but he was brought down to the Wairarapa to counter what I'd said as a anti-super city campaigner, and he was promoted as someone who originally had been opposed to the super city and allegedly led protest marches against the super city when he was one of the ringleaders who pushed for the super city. Blatant lies.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Well, that's basically, I don't see why it's unbelievable. It's the standard modus operandi as far as my experience is with New Zealand media. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the final segment of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on American Freedom Radio from Tuesday through Friday, 3 till 5 p.m. currently is the live time slot for the New Zealanders. And if you happen to be in the good old USSA, the time is 7 o'clock on the Pacific Coast and 10 till midnight on the Eastern Coast and 9 till 11 Central. Obviously, if you know your US time zones, and for those of you in England, unless you're like the latest late-night dogs I've ever conceived of in my life, you know, it's going to be like 2 a.m. till 4 a.m. for you guys. I'm sorry. That's pretty nasty. But then again, late-night conspiracy theorists kind of go together like rice and beans. My very special guest is Penny Bright. And lastly, I wanted to talk about the Mangawhai Ratepayers Association. They've sent me a number of messages. I just haven't been able to get out there, can't afford the gas. But Winston's going out there for an hour-long meeting soon, I hear.
Yes, this Thursday, the 19th of March, from 5 o'clock till 6 o'clock, Winston Peters, he actually made contact with the Mangawhai Residents and Ratepayers Association requesting to meet with them, to hear directly from them. And so this is going to be a very significant meeting, and I, one way or the other, I'm getting up to that meeting, because what's really important is that what happened in Kaiapara with this disgraceful Mike Sabin Kaiapara District Council Rates Validation Act, what that did, central government trumped in over the top of the Kaiapara District Council and basically said that all manner of things were basically okay when they were, where they were corrupt, they were shocking. So that's not the purpose of any validation or legislation, which arguably could be used to fix up little wee stuff-ups, but you know, to try and cover up major, major wrongdoings that cost tens of millions of dollars. It is a disgrace. And what I'm concerned about is that when I eventually get to the High Court applying for a declaratory judgment to check the validity of my rates assessments, notices and invoices, is central government using the precedent set by the Kaiapara District Council Rates Validation Act going to pass legislation to put right things that Auckland Council have allegedly done wrong that affect every single residential rate payer in the entire Auckland region? It's a big deal.
I think that, of course, the media might be there, but, do I sound like a broken record here by saying that when the media turn up, they often don't show what's being said? I mean, number one, they've got about a 30-second to a 90-second tops item for a news story, so they can't exactly show everybody everything that was said. But number two, it's a question of what you omit and what you cover. Are you covering the most important things, the most important details, or are you glossing over it with fluff, with a he said, she said puff piece?
Well, that's true. To give credit where it's due, who's been doing a good job is Claire Swinney. She's been filming meetings that have taken place up in the North, you know, Northland by-election. And hopefully Claire will be there. I need to send a message just to double-check. But hopefully we will have alternative media there.
Do you know if
to actually capture it?
do you know if Claire's actually been uploading those to a YouTube channel? Because if you don't have an official YouTube channel, you have to kind of upload it in 15-minute segments, and that can be pretty difficult. So if you see her there, just let her know that I'll upload all of her public meetings and everything to my channel for her for free if she wants.
Oh, that's very good. Well, what might be a good idea is if we just sort of swap, yeah, details there. But I've just discovered, oh my God, get a load of this. This is a big deal. I have had my reply from the Electoral Commission, and it's outrageous. What I did, I sent an email through on Saturday saying that I wish to make a formal complaint against National Northland candidate Mark Osborne for alleged bribery arising from reported statements he has made to the effect that Northland electors will not get the benefits of more money spent on roading or the like unless they vote for him. I believe that this is in breach of Section 216 of the Electoral Act 1993, and I want to know to whom and the proper process to follow in order to make a formal complaint. Please provide this information at your earliest available opportunity. This is their reply. Dear Ms. Bright, I refer to your complaint. I haven't made a bloody complaint. I'm asking, to whom do I make a complaint? Anyway, I refer to your complaint with regard to the Northland by-election candidate Mark Osborne's comments concerning spending on Northland roading amounting to bribery under the Electoral Act 1993. All parties and candidates contesting an election or by-election are likely to promise different policies and spending priorities in order to persuade electors to vote for them. This allows electors the chance to consider the merits of each party or candidate before voting and will not generally constitute bribery under the Act. The Commission has considered your complaint, which I haven't even made yet, and does not consider that Mark Osborne's statements with regard to spending or lack of spending on Northland roads amounts to bribery under Section 216 of the Electoral Act. I didn't provide one skerrick of evidence to support my complaint, which I haven't yet made. What sort of cover-up, dodgy, bloody bollocks is this?
The kind you're used to and you see happening every single time you question anybody in this government about corrupt practices that they're probably behind and benefiting from and protecting some scumbag!
Well, I mean, I'm going to send that far and wide. I mean, you do appreciate that there's a difference between trying to get it clear to whom I make a complaint. Well, their reply shows that it is the Electoral Commission to whom I make a complaint. I hadn't made a complaint. I was trying to make it clear to whom do I make a complaint. Unbelievable. I'll have fun with this.
It's, well,
that's great. You're the first to hear it.
You can almost tell by how fast they try to pass the buck, how much of a buck they give about your complaint.
Well, the thing is that, I should be sending that one far and wide. That's outrageous. I mean, I just made a generalised statement. I didn't provide any evidence, which you would expect to do. I mean, this is that direct quote that I read you from the newspaper. And everyone's talking about Northland bribes. And this is how they deal with it in supposedly the second least corrupt country in the world. Give me a break.
It's always this way. No, it's not our problem. Hold on a second. I'm just drawing a little bit of a line of conspiracy theorist suspicion here. Do you reckon the GCSB like gave them a little document and said, by the way, she's going to shift you something about bribery and corruption, and this is the section she's probably going to use and whatever, because we were listening to her phone calls?
No, because I'd already spelt that out in my email to them. Because what I've learned, this is a handy hint for people, if you want to know the process to deal with something, go to source. If you want to know how to make, is there a complaints process or whatever, go to whoever it is that you want to make a complaint. I mean, they have not handled this in a proper way at all, in my view. But anyway, I'll be sending that far and wide because I just think that's an absolute disgrace. Maybe what I should do is, if the Electoral Commission aren't even, they're obviously not taking this in any way in a serious form, or maybe I'll just go straight to the cops. And I mean, again, it's each time you go somewhere and put something in a sausage machine, it helps to expose who is or isn't doing their job. But that's outrageous.
Do you remember how long it took you, like how many complaints were laid about John Banks and John Key over the years about certain things that they'd done? And the bounce process that you go from the cops, the Electoral Commission, to the Ombudsman, to the so on and so forth. And it's this kind of like, it's almost like a ring of protection, like they circle the wagons around these people.
Well, that's why it was so significant when Graham McCready took the private prosecution after the police dropped the ball and Graham picked it up. The outcome that resulted in John Banks resigning from Parliament, it showed, for a change, ministers of the Crown are not a protected species.
However,
I mean, you remember...
He did then appeal and won his appeal, but that just means he has to be retrialed, and I'm wondering how much that's going to take out of Graham. I mean, considering
it's out of Graham's hands. It's out of Graham's hands now, because what happened was that then the Solicitor General picked it up. But the thing is, and it's in the hands of the Solicitor General, I mean, there's been other developments which, to be honest, because I've been so flat out with other stuff, I haven't quite got my head around it. But in terms of,
Can we trust this Solicitor General? Because I remember, what was it, the last Solicitor General rocked Vince Seymour around rather maliciously?
Oh, sure, but again... It's all about that public spotlight, in my view. And, I mean, I think that dear old Banks, where he stuffed it up for himself, being on Campbell Live, saying he couldn't remember going on a helicopter to the biggest mansion in New Zealand to meet the biggest German in New Zealand. I mean, people just thought, what? You know, hello? You know, it was just defied credibility. And all these brain fades, etc. What sort of way is that to run a country?
It's a corrupt way to run a country. Ooh, that's a very loud song. Well, thank you very much, Penny Bright, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for tuning in. Those of you who tune in on live streams, please encourage your friends, encourage your family, share it out on Facebook and everything. Search Vinny Eastwood on Facebook. Go to my Facebook page there, give it a like. There's Facebook groups and everything, and one group under Vinny Eastwood that says, only join if you love it. If you join that, you will get messages from me every time I upload a new archive. And some people don't like those Facebook blob-poppy things. So don't worry about that. Just join the Vinny Eastwood Show group or like us on Facebook and you should have access to the archives as they come to you. And also just bear in mind, this is a listener-supported broadcast proudly. And since 2010, we've been trying to deliver regular shows to you and been succeeding for the most part. So thank you so much for your support.